Okay, Mr. Hohenstein, if you are ready to proceed, please do.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Kurt Hohenstein. I'm a self-represented litigant here. The judgment currently before this court is an amalgam of two orders created with a successor court attempting to follow the appellate court's mandate to finalize four matters not finalized originally, grafted its order onto the trial court's verbatim adoption of plaintiff's proposed order, which the trial court entered 679 days after trial. The successor court deferred to the trial court in most cases, but did have to take evidence on those other four matters because it had read and heard no evidence from the trial whatsoever. The trial court adopted the plaintiff's proposed order verbatim, but added its own title to that, final order following trial. Now, we know the trial court did not write that order, but unless we conclude that the trial court did not know what constituted a final order, it likely did not read it. It does not deserve the kind of deference normally accorded an order from a trial court. The order, we contend, violates the rule in Lewis Rand and Newman versus Rare and Kane versus Custer County that due process entitles a litigant to have all the evidence submitted to a single judge who can see the witnesses and weigh their credibility. In this case, that did not happen.
Excuse me, Mr. Hohenstein, with regard to the first order of Judge Vaughn, he saw and heard the witnesses, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the fact that his order followed the proposed order submitted by the plaintiff, does that per se render it incorrect?
No, Your Honor.
And reversible?
Not at all, Your Honor. The court has determined that it does not render it reversible. In fact, it is the order of the trial court. Recognize that, unless there's clear error. And we submit there is ample clear error, and I'll speak about that in just a moment. But that does not render it, it's as good as any other order at first. And one of the first errors we know occurred was the fact that the trial court entered a judgment of $302,000 against a non-party, Billings Trust. Plaintiffs who wrote the order sought to amend that in a motion to amend 11 days after the order was submitted. They knew it was wrong, and they knew it was an error. And we submit there are certain other, that we cited in the brief, certain other examples of errors which would demonstrate the clear error part, which is necessary to really give this order less deference. And that's what we believe the court should do. We also
indicate— And what is our standard of review with regard to that first order?
I think the court, in this case, the circumstances are pretty unusual. The long delay, 679 days, and then the rush that the court had, the court was retiring, frankly, and the rush to enter the order, it entered in 6 days. I would think the court would look at the entire order like de novo. I mean, I think it's important to do that because it is the kind of order that is really rife with error, both legal and factual. And I think the review of the record would show that. Furthermore, we think the lower court lacked subject matter jurisdiction because the plaintiffs had failed to include all qualified beneficiaries from the trust side of the case and did not include the corporation from the derivative side of the case, which are indispensable parties. I think this case is on point with NRA trust created by Augustine, this court's decision on qualified beneficiaries, the same kinds of requests in this case were in that case. And we have two qualified beneficiaries. We clearly, there's no doubt that they are qualified beneficiaries. They're not included. And in a derivative case where it's not a direct action, it's an action on behalf of the corporation, Ripplinger versus Ripplinger, a case I didn't cite in my brief, 154 Nebraska 394, is really sets the rule out, which indicates that's when you need to have the corporation as a party, in this case, party defendant. In the case, and neither of those things happen. And let me just, I've just got a few more seconds left, but the gravamen of the plaintiff's complaint was that the stock was sold in violation of the 1994 stock restriction. And another error the court clearly made is we have in this case a stock restriction agreement pursuant to statute. And that by itself gives notice to the people who receive the gifts. Plaintiffs receive those gifts, but then denied any notice of the restriction. and later indicated that they could only conceive it as a notice to them that the agreement existed if they had received a copy of the stock restriction themselves rather than have to look for it themselves. I know my time is up right now. I'm going to defer to Ms. Schleck for the remainder of the argument. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Stop the clock, please. Thank you. Okay, and now, Ms. Schleck, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please do.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Michelle Schlecht. I'm with the Copland Rocky Law Firm, and I'm here on behalf of Kurt Hohenstein, who's the successor trustee of the Hohenstein Family Trust. There were two assignments of error raised on cross appeal by the successor trustee. The first one that I will address had to do with the finding that Lillian was subject to undue influence by Kurt Hohenstein, and that the 2010 transaction that occurred and the related documents were a result of that undue influence. And very briefly, I think when we look at the facts and the circumstances that were surrounding Lillian at the time that this transaction took place, the evidence showed that Doug and James Hohenstein both testified that when the 1994 agreement to sell all of the stock to Kurt Hohenstein was executed, there was no undue influence, there was no trickery or fraud, that their mom and dad did that of their own free will. And that was the same for the setting of the value from 1994 to 2001. Both of those parties testified that that was of their own free will. The other evidence I think that is important to look at is from the neutral parties that testified, including Lillian's physician, Dr. Kipp, who had done routine mental status evaluations on Lillian. He treated her from 1999 to 2015, said that there was no mental incapacity. Her decision-making was not impaired in 2010 when this transaction occurred. And she had told Dr. Kipp that she wanted Kurt to get the farm and that those were her husband's wishes. One other important witness was Ritz Holtzen. He notarized the 2010 transaction document and prior to signing it said that Lillian had read it several times. She agreed to it. She had a clear understanding of what it meant. She knew what she was signing and she knew that she was transferring ownership to Kurt. So when evaluating these claims of undue influence, again, I think the court is not to be concerned with what may be alleged as the rightness or wrongness or fairness of a conveyance or a transaction. But what we're looking at regarding undue influence is whether it was the voluntary act of the grantor. With regard to the other assignment of error that Lillian that they raised with regard to Lillian was that she had breached her duties as trustee of the Hohenstein Family Trust. And I have very limited time, but this order was primarily focused on a lack of reporting and accounting to the beneficiaries and that the stock was sold to Kurt for less than fair market value.
Wasn't there a concern, counsel, that the valuation hadn't been changed for the stock? As it was required to under the 94 agreement to be reevaluated every year, and then it was later changed to just be fixed. And isn't that a big part of the concern, is that this stock transfer or sale to Kurt was for far less than fair market value?
Yes, I think that is precisely the concern that was raised. And when we look at the evidence, when William and Lillian were evaluating the value and when they executed that 1994 agreement, there was no language in there that was necessarily mandatory that it be sold at fair market value. But the language that was that it would be modified as necessary on a yearly basis. And so for several years from 94 to 2001, they chose not to change that value.
Lillian then in connection with Lillian's trust, and then as her role as trustee of the family trust, doesn't she have that duty to all of the beneficiaries to make sure that these transactions are at fair market value?
Again, I think when we go back to the purpose of the trust and what the intent was and the language that was used, what they were looking at is wanting to keep this in the family. And by setting the value that they did for the years up until William died, and then Lillian continuing on with that value, there was language that she was recognizing all of the value and services that Kurt had provided to them personally, to the trust, to the corporation over the years. And so I think when we look at all of those factors together, that there was no mandatory language, and that Lillian clearly believed that she was exercising the purpose of the trust and what the wishes of her husband were as far as selling the stock to Kurt and keeping the farm in the family. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And the time has elapsed, and there's going to be no remaining time as it relates to that original 10. Mr. Schlosser, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Please do.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Schlosser. I'm here today representing the other three sons in the Hohenstein family, who are the plaintiffs in this case and appear as appellees before the court today. Kurt, in his briefing, seems to try and portray himself as the victim in this case when it was the result of his self-dealing, his secrecy, and his greed that really put us where we're at today in this. As you can see from looking through the record, which is rather voluminous, we've been at this for nearly 10 years now in this case. And through the course of that, even after Kurt has had his day in court and the judge issued the trial orders that we're here on today to review, Kurt has continued to file motion after motion. We've had due process motions. We've had a motion to disqualify the judge. We've had multiple attempted appeals. All of this while the plaintiffs have been incurring tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees over that 10-year period. Two of the plaintiffs, and indeed their mother Lillian, have died while this case has been pending over the last 10 years. Despite all of that, plaintiffs persist in this cause because they truly believe it would not be right for Kurt to benefit from the wrongdoing that he has undertaken in this. Couple of points that I want to talk about on the 1994 agreement. In that agreement, it did state that the intent of the parties was that the price would be modified yearly to reflect increases or decreases in valuation. That did not ever result in a change in value. And then, as Judge Moore pointed out, following William's death in 2001, the agreement was suddenly fixed. And we believe that was a violation of Lillian's trustee duties at that point, when she should have been looking out for the beneficiaries of the trust. She ignored what may change in fair market value and instead set a price forever. I think it's instructive if we go back to the time in 1994 when this agreement was entered into. The record indicates, and Kurt has acknowledged, that William believed at that point in time the price that was set was fair market value. And I think that's a real indication of what the intent of William was at that point in time by setting it at fair market value then. It's also important to note that William had initially offered to sell the farm to one of the other sons, William II. And William II had declined to purchase it because he said, "I can't afford that." There was no talk then coming back about, "Well, it's okay, you don't have to pay fair market value for it. I'll give it to you at a discounted price." The same thing when Kurt entered into this agreement in 1994, the language was that the price would be adjusted, the price was set at fair market value, so there was nothing in that agreement that indicated it was intended to give a significant discount or some bargain to Kurt. While all of that was going on, William and Lillian had been making stock gifts, and in 1994 and 1995, they made equal stock gifts to all five of the children. They didn't prefer Kurt in those stock gifts. And the 94 and 95 gifts came after the 1994 agreement was signed. Again, evidence that William's intent was not to prefer Kurt, but that this was a fair market deal in the 1994 agreement. Around that same time, Kurt also acknowledged in a letter that the parents' estate would eventually be distributed equally upon both of their deaths. So that really sets the stage for what the intent is. And I think Kurt's whole case was built around William's intent was to provide a benefit to Kurt and this big discount off of fair market value. But when you go back to that 1994 timeframe and what was going on, it does not appear that was the case at all. And so then I think we do get into the undue influence portion, that after William's death, Kurt began having Lillian sign certain documents. Kurt began telling her, well, Dad set the price way back when, even though that was not entirely true. And then Lillian agreed in the 2002 agreement to set the price going forward forever. On the undue influence issue, if you look at all of the documents that Lillian signed that are in the record, it really shows how she was essentially signing anything that Kurt would ask her to sign.
How do you know that? What in the record tells us that? I assume it wasn't Lillian's testimony.
That's true. There is no testimony of Lillian in the record. She died before trial and before a deposition was taken in this case. So what we have to go on that are the items that she did sign. And so things that she signed were contrary to what the independent witnesses that Ms. Schlecht mentioned had testified, and that her children had testified, that Lillian was an honest and upstanding lady, yet she was signing documents that were not accurate, were not true. So in the record and in our brief, we lay out how Kurt's employment agreements could not have been entered into when he said they were. And he got caught in false testimony on that at trial. Lillian signed all of those documents stating that, you know, they were entered into on those dates. That was not true. She signed amended corporate bylaws that said these are a fair and accurate or true and accurate copy of bylaws that existed before. That was not accurate. They had been modified.
And even if we would agree with those statements, though, counsel, how does that then bring us within the realm of undue influence?
Yes, because Lillian was not making decisions on her own at that point. All of those documents together show that these were Kurt's decisions that were being made. And, you know, for example, look at in the 2010 transaction. As part of that, Lillian gave away the house that she was living in to the corporation. There was no compensation for that in the deal. Kurt acknowledged at trial that was an error. He should have paid for that. But she was no longer even going to be a stockholder in the corporation, yet she was giving her house away for that. So I think that shows that just the pattern of all those things, that Kurt was replacing his mind with hers as the elements of undue influence require. And so it was really his decisions that were being made. He would put those documents in front of her, they would get signed. So that the combination of all those things leads up to the undue influence.
So it's really a review of the documents, not any particular witness testimony that you're relying upon for that proposition.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right. Looking at the documents that were signed, although contrasting that with the testimony about what Lillian's character was. So these documents seem out of context with the character that everyone has testified. So it's either she was putting on an act that, you know, the friends that testified at trial, her children that testified at trial, that they did not know her, and she was doing things against the other children, or she didn't know what she was doing and was being influenced by Kurt and all that. And I think that's a much more reasonable step to take looking at the documents that were signed.
Before we run out of time, I have something I want to make sure I ask. With regard to the 1994 agreement, as I understand, as I look at your brief, there were gifts of stock in the corporation made prior to that time as well to the kids. Is that correct?
That's correct. So there were stock gifts made an error in 1975 because the corporation actually hadn't been formed. Then replacement gifts were made in 1976. And then there were stock gifts made in 1980 as well.
So does the 1994 agreement giving him an option, Kurt an option to buy the shares, did that only implicate the shares of William and Lillian, or were they trying to make that option with regard to everybody's shares?
Kurt has asserted that they were trying to do that for everyone's shares. And so Kurt later on in the 2010 timeframe, you'll see in the record, and I believe we discussed that seminar brief, had asserted that he had a right to purchase all of the shares, even the ones that had previously been gifted to the other children.
Do you take the position the 94 agreement's not valid, meaning Lillian and William had a right to give Kurt an option if they wanted to with regard to their shares at that point, right?
Correct. We don't believe that the 94 agreement is invalid. Okay. Had the changes to fair market value occurred throughout the years, and had Kurt paid fair market value for the corporation in 2010, we wouldn't be here today.
Okay. Thanks.
And with that, I see that my time has expired, so we would respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's rulings.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, again, for joining us remotely, those that did and those that are in person, and the matter is now submitted.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.